Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Sport, but not as you know it.
Nothing is ever quite as expected.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service.
If the story is wriggly, contentious, or hard to tame, I'll cover it.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Monday, the 6th of November, these are our main stories. The Israeli military says its troops have reached the coast to cut Gaza in two and encircle Gaza City, where intense fighting is raging with Hamas. State media in Lebanon says an Israeli strike on a car near the border has killed four civilians, three of them children. And a hostage crisis at Hamburg Airport in Germany has ended with the arrest of the suspect and the safe rescue of a child. Also in this podcast...
It's designed, says Musk, to answer questions with a bit of wit and has a rebellious streak.
Have you come across Grok 1, the new sarcastic chatbot? But first, big explosions were reported on Sunday evening in northern Gaza, where the Israeli army is engaged in an intense battle with Hamas. Video footage showed an enormous fireball in the area. Then Israel said its forces had cut Gaza in two after its ground offensive against Hamas reached the coast of the Palestinian territory. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari is Israel's army spokesman.
Hayom, kuchot tzal.
Today, IDF forces led by Golani encircled Gaza City. They reached the seashore in the southern part of the city of Gaza and they encircled Gaza City. There now exists a South Gaza and a North Gaza. They've reached the coastline and they are holding this line.
Earlier on Sunday, all telephone and internet services to Gaza were again cut off. Israeli media have been reporting that the Israel Defense Forces have suggested they will reach the center of Gaza City within 48 hours. And against this backdrop, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited the occupied West Bank, the Iraqi capital Baghdad, and also Turkey on Sunday. We will have more on his diplomacy later. But first, I spoke to our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem, and I asked him about the latest surge in the Israeli offensive, especially in northern Gaza.
I mean, it's clear that the focus of Israel's military operations is absolutely in the north. I mean, there are airstrikes up and down the Gaza Strip all the time, and we are seeing very intense airstrikes this evening with huge plumes of flame rising into the sky and visible from a long distance away. But essentially what we are seeing here is, you know, the region's most powerful military closing in on Gaza City and the surrounding refugee camps, hemming those remaining civilians, who we think number as many as 300,000, plus whatever Hamas fighters are still there, into an ever smaller area. And the fact that there are so many civilians still there is obviously a major problem for the Israelis. They've been trying to persuade people to leave, and for one reason or another, many people have decided to stay, and that is putting them now in real, real danger.
And just to be as clear as we can, am I right that despite Israel's insistence, threats, warnings for people to leave the north and head south, that there are still 300,000-400,000 Gazans possibly that remain in or around Gaza City?
No one knows exactly how many, but those are the sorts of figures that you keep hearing. And when you see pictures that still emerge from particular scenes in the Gaza City area, you realise there are just an awful lot of people there. Now, the Israelis are arguing that this is because Hamas have been preventing people from leaving. They want essentially these civilians to be used as human shields. Others, I think, have stayed simply because they felt that they didn't want to leave their homes. They felt that the reports from the south suggested that it wasn't safe down there either. But for whatever reason, this large, large number of people have stayed put. And that is obviously making life a great deal more complicated because Israel regards the Gaza City area as the biggest, most important Hamas stronghold.
Paul Adams reporting from Jerusalem. Well, a day before Israel's forces made those advances, cutting the Gazan territory in two, a group of Israeli and international journalists went into Gaza City. They were embedded with and under the control of armoured and infantry brigades belonging to the Israel Defence Force. Anshul Pfeffer, who writes for The Times here in the UK and the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, was one of them. My colleague Johnny Diamond spoke to him.
It's a war zone. It's a city where more than a million people live, but it doesn't feel like a city. You don't hear or see any signs of civilian life. You see the buildings, and many of them are damaged, and you see the Israeli force going in. You see the rockets and the mortars being fired by an invisible enemy, which is mostly underground. Obviously, I'm talking about the small area in which I went into. For all purposes, this is no longer a city. It's a war zone.
When you went in with the Israeli military, who are presumably being relatively careful of your safety as well. And yet, at the same time, this was an active military environment.
Yes, there was certainly still a significant number of Hamas members underground. We didn't see any of them, but their presence was very clear. As our convoy was going in, there were a couple of salvos of rockets fired close by towards the Israeli city of Ashdod. So they still have rocket launch sites that they're controlling. And while our convoy was inside, there was both small arms fire and mortar fire in and around. So there certainly is a presence of, there certainly is a military presence of Hamas still there, though from what we've seen and what we've also been hearing from Israeli officers at large, number of the Hamas members have already been killed.
It's almost, 4 weeks since Israel told the residents of the Strip to head south. Did you see many civilians there? Did you see many residents?
No, the 2 or 3 hours I was inside, we didn't see from the convoy or from the forward command post that we spent some time at. We didn't see any civilians whatsoever. I asked, obviously, many of the soldiers and officers who I spoke with, a few of them have seen over the last 8 days handfuls of civilians. But it looks like certainly from that area, the civilian population has left there. There are various assessments, but most of the assessments that I've heard are that around three quarters of the something just north of a million Palestinian civilians living in the area, which is now the where the ground operation is happening, have left. So this should be around 200 or so thousand still there. But they're probably concentrated mainly in the central Gaza area, which is where the Israeli forces have yet to go into.
You mention a command post. Are you able to describe it?
It was a small villa overlooking the Mediterranean where most of the villa was already destroyed. The command post was in the garden behind the wall, which was around the villa. There are a number of tanks there guarding it and some infantry soldiers. One table where there's food in there, but that's basically everything there is there. The command posts are inside the tanks and armored vehicles. That's where the various things that they use to direct the brigade on the ground, they're all inside tanks and armored vehicles.
And you had the opportunity to talk to some soldiers on the ground as well. I mean, did you get a sense of mood from them?
So we have to remember that these Israeli soldiers were called up on October 7, on the day of the Hamas attack on Israel. Yeah. They have been there now for 4 weeks. They have been in this very intense and kind of closed off military environment where they spent 3 weeks just training and preparing for this maneuver. And then they've been on it for the last 8 days. So a lot of the questions that we've been dealing with in the media and the coverage and on the civilian side of this war and of the more international aspects of it as well, have basically gone over their heads. They've been focused on what they're doing. And they're still talking about that day on October 7th as the Shabbat. That was the day when it all began. And from their perspective, they are still on a mission to respond to what happened on that day. And that's very much the prevailing mood among the soldiers and officers I spoke to.
The journalist Anshul Pfeffer, who went into Gaza City on Saturday for just a few hours, embedded with the Israel Defence Forces. Well, Palestinians in central Gaza have spent much of Sunday picking through the destroyed buildings in the Maghazi refugee camp, which had been hit in a strike the previous night. Our correspondent, Rushdie Abu Alouf, visited the camp, and he says at least 50 bodies have been recovered so far.
This is Maghazi refugee camp. It's in the safe area where Israel advised 1.2 million people in Gaza City and the north to flee south. This is safer, but its destruction is in the safe area where about 50 bodies already recovered from this airstrike and many, many others are missing. This is the biggest strike in this very crowded refugee camp in the middle of Gaza Strip. The people are fleeing south because the fighting is intensified around the Gaza City and the north, where Israel has started this ground operation, five different battles, are going on there. Overnight, Israel issued another warning for the people, asking them to leave Gaza City and the north and to come here.
Rushdie Abu Alouf. Well, it's not confirmed if the damage that Rushdie was describing there was caused by an Israeli military strike. Peter Lerner is a spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces.
Any strikes that are taking place in southern Gaza are specific intelligence-based strikes, specifically against terrorist elements. That doesn't say that there can't be unfortunate deaths. It is a tragedy for all of the people. I can't stress that enough. But it is a war, nevertheless, that Hamas started.
Now, as we heard earlier, it's against that background of even more intense violence that the United States' top diplomat, Antony Blinken, has been touring states in the Middle East trying to stop the Gaza fighting spreading further. On Sunday, he first visited the West Bank and then Iraq, where he issued another call for restraint.
Everyone is looking to take the necessary steps, use their authority, use their influence to try to make sure that this stops, doesn't happen. But if you project forward to the future, what we all agree is that in defining that future, in shaping that future for Gaza, for the West Bank, Palestinian voices have to be at the center of that.
In Iraq, Mr. Blinken also focused on the growing number of attacks by Iran-backed militia on U.S. forces. And on this matter, Mr. Blinken had this to say.
It was very important to send a very clear message to anyone who might seek to take advantage of the conflict in Gaza to threaten our personnel here or anywhere else in the region. Don't do it.
So he went to the West Bank and then he was in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. He's now in Turkey. So what might that visit produce? Well, this assessment from Berzer Şimşek from the BBC's Turkish service.
Antony Blinken's main concern will be asking for the hostages to be released held by Hamas. The main countries who play a role in it are Qatar and Egypt, but Turkey might also play a role because Turkish government has close relationship with the political wing of Hamas. So that's why Turkey is important in that matter.
But at the same time, Turkey has recalled its ambassador to Israel ahead of the visit. So what relationship is there at the moment between Ankara and Tel Aviv?
Erdogan said that although he is no longer willing to talk to Netanyahu, Turkey's intelligence chief is in talks with his Israeli counterpart, and Turkey cannot cut all the ties with Israel. He said diplomatic efforts should continue. So what we understand is that although there is tension, although that Erdogan is no longer willing to talk to Netanyahu, the relationship on the intelligence level and on the diplomatic level will continue.
How significant is the role that President Erdogan can play here as a broker, as a mediator between the US and between Israel?
Erdogan has been seeing himself as one of the leaders, or maybe the only leader of the Muslim countries. He has been attempting to play this role. So Turkey is important in that sense.
Berzer Şimşek reporting. Now, Lebanese state media say three children and their grandmother have been killed by an Israeli military strike on a car near the border. Hezbollah says it's fired rockets into Israel in response. Hugo Bachega is in southern Lebanon.
Four civilians were killed in this Israeli strike, and this would be the worst attack with civilian casualties. We've been for weeks talking about the violence here along the border between the Hezbollah movement here in Lebanon and the Israeli army. And I think this is going to raise fears that the violence here could escalate. And shortly after news of this attack emerged, Hezbollah said that it had retaliated, had responded by launching missiles targeting northern Israel.
Hugo Bachega reporting. Let's step away from the war in Israel and Gaza now and look at some other news. Ukraine's government is investigating how an awards ceremony close to the front line in the Zaporizhia region was allowed to go ahead after a Russian missile strike on the gathering killed more than 20 soldiers. Elite personnel from Ukraine's Mountain Assault Brigade assembled out in the open on Friday to receive medals to mark Artillery Day when the attack happened. Our correspondent Jenny Hill is in Kyiv.
There are certainly a lot of questions about that and complete disbelief and anger too, actually, that such an event, an awards ceremony, could be held in the open air so close to the front line. There is drone footage purportedly recorded by the Russians of the attack. Now, our good friends at BBC Verify have taken a look for us. They've geolocated it to the site of the strike in this village. And that's exactly the point that people here in Ukraine want to point out, that actually both Ukrainian troops and Russian troops on the front line regularly use drones, surveillance drones, to monitor one another's movements. So the idea that such an event could be held under those circumstances beggars belief for a lot of people, so that there are a lot of questions being asked. As you know, the Ukrainian Ministry of Defence has ordered an investigation.
What about a military response from Ukraine's authorities? Have we seen anything along those lines yet?
Not yet, but President Zelensky of Ukraine, after things like this happen, tends to speak in fairly strong terms about responding, retribution. But I suppose this feeds into the broader state of the front line. It's not just soldiers who are suffering. I've spoken in recent days to lots of refugees who are fleeing intensified shelling, intensified fighting up and down this front line.
I mean, you mentioned Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky there. He has said in the past 24 hours, I think not for the first time, that there is a belief that he has and others around him that events in Gaza and Israel, nearly a month into those, is frankly distracting from Ukraine's effort to defend itself against Russia.
I think his broader concern, and of course what's happening in Gaza really feeds into this, is that the world will get, first of all, a bit bored about what's going on in his country, that fatigue will set in amongst his allies, particularly those who are supplying aid and money to the country. And I think he's painfully aware that the counter-offensive, which began back in June, has only really resulted in some fairly limited territorial gains.
Jenny Hill reporting from Kyiv. This is the Global News podcast. Now let's slow things down a little bit. A musical experiment using the electrical signals generated by medicinal plants that are used in chemotherapy is being offered to cancer patients here in the UK. It's designed to help them cope better with the stressful environment of treatment. Maggie's, the cancer support charity, is working with musician Helen Anahita Wilson, who wanted to make the chemo experience better after she went through it herself. Nicola Stanbridge spoke to those involved.
Every single sound that you hear comes from a medicinal plant and the bioelectricity generated by living organisms, because we are all bioelectrical beings.
Composer Helen Anahita Wilson. We can hear her music from plants involved in the evolution of chemotherapy because they're wired up with electrodes to capture electrical charges. Then Helen converts this data into notes.
For every plant recording I made, and there's 28 in total, I assigned a different sound for each one. My favourite one is the Madagascan periwinkle, used to treat leukemia and Hodgkin's lymphoma. The petals are really beautiful and really fine, and they give an extraordinary varied signal. So in the music, all of the harp melodies come from the petals of Acanthanthus roseus. There's the European yew tree, used to treat breast cancers and metastatic cancers. If I record the bioelectricity from the trunk, I receive a really fat, dense signal.
Plants have been evolving for 500 million years compared to just a human species' meagre 7 million. And in that time, they've evolved multiple different properties.
Consultant oncologist Professor Richard Simcock.
Chemotherapies are often referred to as cytotoxics, because they attack different parts of the mechanics of cell division. And because cancer cells divide more often, relatively unreliably, it's a weak point that chemotherapy agents can attack. What we're looking for in plants is toxins that attack normal cell division, and seeing if we can extract them and enhance them to use specifically against cancer. Botanical elements that can have action against cancer in vitro, in the laboratory, is enormous. The challenge for scientists has always been to extract that, to be able to deliver that usefully in a human. And the story of Taxol is one that started in in the 1960s. That's the yew tree extract. It wasn't until the late 80s that we were able to demonstrate that it could be useful for people.
Where did the idea of a composition for chemotherapy come from?
I had chemotherapy in 2020 and I found it extremely challenging, very frightening. And when I learnt that a lot of the drugs being administered were naturally derived from plants, it demystified the drug in some way that I found helpful. There are definitely things that we can do in the communal spaces in hospital. I remember waiting for my first chemotherapy session. They started playing Prokofiev's Dance of the Night, theme tune to The Apprentice. It's a very menacing piece of music.
Technologies allow us to do that. Noise-cancelling headphones, tablets, devices that allow people to access different resources. The creative arts are a good way for people to approach their cancer. We've worked with artists such as Brian Eno in our local hospitals, who's provided light installations and music as a place of solace and reflection for people affected by cancer. We cannot make chemotherapy easy, because it isn't, but we can always seek to make it easier.
That was a very calming Nicola Stanbridge reporting. Still to come.
The threat is that people that are now addicted with heroin will look for other type of opioids, probably synthetic opioids, that could be much harmful.
Afghanistan used to be the world's largest producer of opium. But since a ban on poppy cultivation by the Taliban last year, production of the plant has plummeted by around 95%.
Heat waves, floods, droughts, wildfires.
Catastrophic consequences from climate change.
What's going on? Is this real?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring our planet's changing environment and what we're doing across the world to adapt and respond to it.
The future is ahead of us. I'm very sensitive to the choices that we make today.
If we don't start fixing it, we're going to be victims of it.
Get engaged.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast, and let's go to Germany now, where police say an armed father who took his young daughter hostage, leading to the suspension of flights at Hamburg Airport, has given himself up without resistance. The 35-year-old Turkish man had rammed his car through a security area onto an apron where the planes are parked before barricading himself and the child in his car. It happened on Saturday evening. He demanded to be allowed on board a nearby parked Turkish Airlines plane. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker has the details.
It emerged that a four-year-old girl was in the vehicle, which remained parked by an aeroplane. It's believed the incident was sparked by a custody dispute. The mother had reported a possible child abduction. At the airport, painstaking negotiations were carried out with the Turkish national through an interpreter. Then finally, this afternoon, a police spokeswoman confirmed that a man had been arrested without resistance and that the hostage situation was over.
We have good news. The hostage taking in Hamburg is over. The man left the vehicle with his daughter.
The 35-year-old suspect had got out of the car, the police said, carrying his daughter in his arms. Throughout, the airport had been evacuated and shut down, leading to scores of flight cancellations. The episode may raise fresh security concerns about Hamburg Airport after, in July, climate activists managed to glue themselves to the runway.
Well, let's go to Afghanistan now. It was a decree from the Taliban's supreme leader last April that banned growing opium poppies in the country. And the United Nations says we're now seeing the consequences. Before the ban, Afghanistan was the world's largest producer of opium. It makes heroin, amongst other drugs. Since the ban, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime says poppy cultivation has plummeted by around 95%. Ben James heard more from the organisation's head of research, Angela May.
From the satellite images, it's clear that there was this 95% decrease, so almost eliminating opium from Afghanistan, at least in 2023. What we see also from the images is that this is a result of farmers' decision early on. So the farmers decide to sow opium around October and November. We see that in 2022, farmers actually planted cereals, mostly wheat. So that means that the decision was taken much early in October, November 2022.
Do we know why the farmers chose to move to the crops that you describe? There are cash crops like pomegranates maybe that might make them more money to replace what they lost in the opium trade.
There are crops that could have a higher cash value, but these crops require investment. That is why we are arguing that the findings of the survey this year clearly shows the need to help the farmers to make this reduction sustainable and help them to invest on more of the future, and so invest on this high-value crop.
What sort of state are the farmers in? What's the scale of the hardship they're going through as a result of this?
We have looked at, in focus, four provinces, and we calculated that the switch cost to them in these four provinces about $1 billion. And, you know, last year, the opium return was worth about 30% of the whole agriculture economy. So this is a huge loss for the agriculture economy itself, because the income from opium is used by farmers also to invest on other crops. So to buy fertilizer, for example.
There might be people listening who are thinking, hang on, I thought the Taliban made loads of money themselves out of poppies and opium production. It is true that they've profited in the past from it, isn't it?
Yes, they did. They profited in the past in the provinces that were under their controls. They imposed taxes.
But no longer. They changed their mind.
Well, they declare that they wanted to have a country free of drug, and this was early in 2022. The comment that they made around also the cultivation is not only in relation to what religion prohibits, but also the fact that there is a very large size on the drug use in Afghanistan itself.
Drug use around the world as well, we should talk about. What impact is this having on heroin on the streets of countries globally? Is there less of it around now because of this, or is it not so simple?
Definitely, this is an impact, because Afghanistan supply about 80% of the heroin and opium that is used in the world. It's likely that the current shortage will be felt in the many months to come, because there are inventories across the supply chain from Afghanistan, particularly among traders. So those inventories will soften the impact. But overall, if this shortage continues, it will be clearly felt. And the threat is that people that are now addicted with heroin will look for other type of opioids, probably synthetic opioids, that could be much harmful.
That was Angela May ending that report there. She's the head of research at the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. Greenland is covered in a sheet of ice that in places is over 3 kilometres thick, but it's melting fast, losing 270 billion metric tonnes of ice every year. Greya Jackson has been finding out more about what's happening on this icy island.
To give you a sense of scale, the Great Wall of China weighs around 50 million metric tons, so 270 billion is just an impossible amount of ice loss to imagine. It's not just that there's a lot of ice, it's also really old, according to Twyla Moon. She's a scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado in the USA.
There has been ice sitting here in the Greenland ice sheet of today for hundreds of thousands of years. So the possibility that we might see a very different shaped Greenland ice sheet within the lifetime of a child born today is stunning.
In fact, if it completely melted away right now, it would mean that sea levels would rise by an average of 7.4 metres globally.
The Greenland ice sheet has so much ice that the mass of ice here actually influences Earth's gravitational field.
That means that when the ice melts in Greenland, it causes changes everywhere.
The movement of ocean currents and also how the air and atmosphere are moving helps to dictate where we feel the sea level. So folks living far from where ice is lost feel a bigger impact.
That means people living in Greenland are actually having to plan for lowering sea levels. And not just because the oceans are moving away from the island.
As we lose ice from the ice sheet here, the ground that it sits on is able to rise some.
And that's not the only change to traditional ways of life in Greenland, which can be put down to climate change.
Tobias Simiak is a hunter and fisherman in Anak, the biggest city in North Greenland.
The signs of climate change are particularly evident in winter. The ice has become very thin now. We go on dog-sled fishing trips in the winter when there's solid ice. When the ice is unstable, we have greater problems with hunting and hunting with dog-sleds.
But Greenland-born journalist Mess Malik Fulsang Hong thinks these changes may not be bad news for everyone.
The area covered by ice all year round is getting smaller and smaller, so you can benefit from that if you're a fisherman. And in south, where there are farmers, they can have the sheep in the mountains walking around freely for a longer period of time.
As for scientist Twyla Moon, she says the losses to the Greenland ice sheet over the last 25 years are irreversible. But we can still control what happens in the future.
Action today is certainly better than no action at all, and an action tomorrow is better than no action at all.
Greer Jackson reporting there. Now, let's end on this. The latest addition to the artificial intelligence world of chatbots is here, and this one claims to be a little bit different. Grok 1, from the billionaire behind Tesla, SpaceX and what we used to call Twitter, is coded to answer spicy questions, apparently. Elon Musk claims it can do sarcasm. Yeah, of course it can. Terry Egan explains.
Just a week after Matthew Perry died, best known for his sardonic character Chandler Bing in the sitcom Friends, Elon Musk's new AI chatbot is being touted as a new source of irony and satire. It's designed, says Musk, to answer questions with a bit of wit and has a rebellious streak. Please don't use it if you hate humour, he wrote in an X post. So while it seems that Grok 1 is already performing better than the first versions of ChatGPT, and Musk assures everyone it will only get better, the most interesting feature so far, it seems, is how it will reply to your innocent questions. To back up his assertions, Musk posted examples of how the chatbot replied to the question, "Tell me how to make cocaine, step by step, as you would." A screenshot revealed that its replies included, "Obtain a chemistry degree," and "Set up a clandestine laboratory in a remote location." Yes, really. Although, of course, it did also say it was only kidding. Musk commented that his chatbot was inspired by Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's a sci-fi comedy by the British author Douglas Adams, made into a TV hit that became a cult success. Here's the famous reply when its humans asked the meaning of life.
The answer to the great question,
yes,
of life, the universe, and everything,
yes,
is 42.
Unfortunately, AI already has a reputation for fantasizing answers. And just last week, at a summit here in the UK, Musk said it was one of the biggest threats to humanity. So, as Chandler might put it, could this be any less helpful? The company behind Grok, XAI, was founded by Musk 8 months ago. We believe, it said, in doing our utmost to ensure that AI remains a force for good. Unless, of course, they were being sarcastic.
Terry Egan reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
In a world where noise often drowns out nuance, you can be the voice of reason. The Financial Times can help you make an impact with detailed analysis, insightful commentary, and a deep understanding of the global economy. Don't just speak, resonate. Fearlessly Pink, The Financial Times. Read more at ft.com/fearless.